If you would take your Bibles, let's turn to the book of Job. Turn to the book of Job. One of my goals this evening is to preach through an entire book of the Bible, and I thought I would pick the one with the shortest name, Job. Now, Job ends up, there's 42 chapters. We're going to start in chapter 1 and end in chapter 42, Lord willing, today. Job is an amazing, a fascinating book. A lot of things contained in Job. It's the oldest book in our Bible. It would even, it does not predate the creation, but it predates when Moses wrote down the account of creation. Many scholars believe Job lived at the same time period as Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob during the time of the patriarchs. Job, in it, is the longest account of Satan speaking. In it is the longest account of God speaking to man. Four chapters, uninterrupted. Except for chapters 1, chapter 2, and chapter 42, the rest of the book is talking. There's one question that I want to drive towards as we make our way through the book, and we will get there. But we must begin looking at Job the man, and then we'll look at Job the story, how it unfolded, and how all that talking went. Let's ask God's blessing as we look into the life of Job. Lord, we do need your help, even as was just sung. We need it at all times of life. Lord, there are some here that are they acknowledge that they need you, and they desperately are looking for you. Lord, there are some of us who long to hear from you, and Lord, there are some here who don't care either way whether they hear from you. And Lord, I pray that each one of us, Lord, that our hearts, whatever trial that we are going through, whatever place we are spiritually, that we will turn our attention to you and recognize our need of you. Lord, I pray that you would guide as we look through this book of Job that you've given us. You've given it to edify us, to grow us, to convict us. And Lord, I pray as we look through this story briefly that you will work in our hearts in our situations. Lord, you know all about us. You have all power to change circumstances, and you love us. And Lord, I pray that we would hold on to those three truths even as we go through the message. In Jesus' name I pray, amen. Job the man, let's look at him just for a moment. His character, we find in verse 1 we're introduced. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was perfect and upright, one that feared God and eschewed evil. Just four characteristics thrown out here right at the beginning. Verse 1, you find out that the man is perfect. It's the idea of being complete or whole. Or in contrast to the idea of being upright, the perfectness is internal holiness. Internally, the man is holy. He's not a facade. Externally, you see that he is upright. He is right down the line. He's a straightforward guy. He does everything above the table. This is Job. Everyone knew he's upright. That's his reputation. But in God's eyes, he was complete. He was whole. He was perfect. So internally, holy. Externally, he was honest. If you look in the book of Ezekiel, he's listed alongside Noah and Daniel as some of the most righteous people who have ever lived. God said Israel had sinned so much that even if Noah and Daniel and Job were to come and they lived in Israel during that time period, they would be spared alone, not even their families, not even the nation. If they had prayed as Moses prayed, God would not spare the nation. Job was one of the most righteous people ever to have lived, being included in that list. He was perfect. He was upright. He was God-fearing. He cared what God had to say about things, and he lived his life according to how God said to do things. He eschewed evil. That means he avoided it. He shunned it. He didn't cozy up to it. He didn't entertain it. He shunned it. He avoided it. Now tonight, if God were to measure us up, if we were to begin our story, there was a man in the land of Shelby whose name was, and what description would we have? Now, this is the description of the writer of the book of Job, who happens to be God the Holy Spirit. In chapter 2, the Lord is talking to Satan in verse 3 and says, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil." The conversation on earth was the same as the conversation in heaven, the conversation in the book. It all said the same thing about Job. He was a guy that spiritually is far above, far beyond. He's an example. What would God say if he were to describe us with this kind of clarity? We go on and see some of his condition. He is extremely wealthy. Well, we skipped verse 2. He's a family man. There was born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. Then we see his wealth in verse 3. His substance also was 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 she-asses, and a very great household, so that this man was the greatest of all the men of the East. He was on the top list of all the wealthy men in the East. I calculated up this. Well, I found someone who calculated all the values of this up today, and they came out with a value of $56 million. Now, that's far below the wealthiest man of the West nowadays. But this guy was wealthy. He was a great father. If you look later on in verse 4, it says, his sons went and feasted in their houses, everyone his day, and sent and called for their 3 sisters to eat and to drink with them. I noticed that his children got along. Job did something as a father, and he was an example that his children made the choice that they were going to get along even as they grew up and had their own houses. Now, maybe they visited every birthday, they had a feast in their own house, and they invited the whole family to come together. We're not sure exactly what that everyone his day, that might be what it means, his birthday. But Job led his family, they all got along. More than that, Job concerned himself as a father that his children would be right with God. We see that in the next verse. And it was so when the days of their feasting were gone about that Job sent and sanctified them and rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus did Job continually. Job was a man that demonstrated just a diligence, a thoroughness, a character trait that he did it continually. So here we have a man, perfect, upright, God-fearing, sin-avoiding, extremely wealthy, great father. He's also respected in society. Would you go to Job chapter 29? Chapter 29. Job was respected by all in society, really. Verse 8, it says, the young men saw me and hid themselves. The aged arose and stood up. Even today we stand when folks enter into the room and gentlemen, we show respect for elderly folks that have come in. We get the door and we show respect that way. Even the aged arose when Job came in and stood up. Verse 9, the princes refrained talking, laid their hand upon their mouth. The nobles held their peace, their tongue cleaved to the roof of their mouth. Politicians not talking when this man's around. That's almost a miracle. Verse 11, when the ear heard me, then it blessed me. When the eye saw me, it gave witness to me. Verse 21, unto me men gave ear and waited and kept silence at my counsel. After my words they spake not again. My speech dropped upon them. Verse 25, I chose out their way and sat chief and dwelt as a king in the army, as one that comforteth the mourners. When Job walked into the room, everything else just kind of died down. Job's here. People came to Job for advice. Job, what should I do in this matter? And then nobody had a summary when he was done. They just all went home quietly after the advice he gave. This man was respected in society. The epitome of almost everything, a father, a man of God, a counselor, and a leader in society. That's his condition. That's his character. Now, we know the man, Job. Let's look at his story. And let's look at that without the behind-the-scenes knowledge of what goes on in chapter 2. Because Job did not have that when he was facing life. We do not have the behind-the-scenes knowledge that is facing us when we are facing our life. We don't know what all is going on in heaven. We don't know what's going on with God and Satan and the world that he leads. We know a few things, as the Bible tells us, but we don't have the details. And Job didn't have the details. So let's look at it as Job saw it. Verse 13. And there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. And there came a messenger unto Job. I'm sorry, chapter 1, verse 13. We're back at the beginning. We'll be jumping around quite a bit. We have to if we're going to get done. Verse 14. Chapter 1. And there came a messenger unto Job and said, now, as I read, you have to imagine in your mind, this all happens as fast as I'm reading it. The oxen were plowing and the asses were feeding beside them, and the Sabians fell upon them and took them away. Yea, they have slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped to tell thee. While he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, the fire of God has fallen from heaven and hath burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I only am escaped to tell thee. While he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, the Chaldeans made out three bands and fell upon the camels, and they have carried them away, yea, and slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee. While he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, thy sons and thy daughters were eating and drinking wine in the eldest brother's house. And behold, there came a great wind from the wilderness and smote the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young men, and they are dead. And I only am escaped to tell thee. That's the amount of time Job got all this news. Everything in his life was lost in that moment. All his wealth, his future, in a sense, as all his children were gone. No one to carry on the name of Job. No one to carry on the character that he had instilled in his children. No one to go on and keep his memory alive. He lost all his respect in society. You could mark down in chapter 30, verse 1, Job is saying, but now they that are younger than I have me in derision, whose fathers I would have disdained to set with the dogs of my flock. In verse 9, and now Job says, I am their song. Yea, I am their byword. They abhor me. They flee far from me and spare not to spit in my face. Job didn't just lose his respect and become just a nobody. He became the talk of everyone. He became the derision of everyone. He lost all respect in society. He lost his wealth, his children, his respect. You know, Job lost everything that was external. He didn't lose his character. Look at Job's response, verse 20 of chapter 1. Then Job arose and rent his mantle and shaved his head and fell down upon the ground and worshiped and said, naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly. My question that I'm driving towards is, how do we respond to suffering? How do we respond to suffering? Job worships God. We have a hymn in our hymnal, number 49, Blessed Be the Name of the Lord. It's such an upbeat song, isn't it? All praise to him who reigns above. On the chord, blessed be the name, blessed be. That's not the way that Job sang it when he first said this. He was in a state when he had lost everything. And he gets down and he worships God and he says, blessed be the name of the Lord. He hung on to his character and he sinned not. Let's move on in the story. This is where Job is. He goes and he sits down outside the town where they burn the garbage. He's down at the city dump. In verse 7, the next thing Job knows is he is afflicted. Chapter 2, verse 7. Would you look there halfway through the verse? The next thing Job knows, he's lost everything, and now he is smitten with sore boils from the sole of his foot unto his crown. And he took with him a potsherd to scrape himself withal, and he sat down among the ashes. That's the next thing Job knows. He's lost everything, and a short time later, he's afflicted. Sore boils. Throughout the book of Job, Job recounts his medical situation. Just a short list described. There's itching. There's insomnia. He can't sleep at night. There are running sores, just sores that ooze out pus and different things that we don't like to talk about. He has nightmares. There's weight loss. Not the kind that he would hope for, but weight loss. He can't eat during the day. He has diarrhea. His skin is blackening. In fact, he's so disfigured when his friends see him from afar off, they can't even recognize that that is their friend, Job. Job's wife, his friends show up in verse 9. Job's wife says unto him, chapter 2, verse 9, "Dost thou still retain thine integrity? Curse God and die." There's another response we could have to suffering. The first response we see with Job where he worshiped the Lord. And I submit to you that's the correct response. The second response I see is Job's wife says, just curse God and die. God did this to you. Just curse him and that be the end of your life. Verse 10, but he said unto her, "Thou speakest as one of the foolish women speaketh." What? "Shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? In all this did not Job sin with his lips." Now, when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that were come upon him, they came every one from his own place. We have three friends who come, and these are good friends. I don't know how many people in my life, if they were going through a trial, and I would go and sit with them at a city dump for 7 days and seven nights. Would you do that for some of your friends? Do you have friends that would do that for you? But these three, they came, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. They came and they had made an appointment to come and mourn with Job and to comfort him. Verse 12, when they lifted up their eyes afar off, they knew him not. They lifted up their voice and wept. They rent everyone his mantle and sprinkled dust upon their heads toward heaven. So they sat down with him upon the ground 7 days and seven nights, and none spake a word unto him, for they saw that his grief was very great. Just on the get-go, these three friends, those are some solid friends. They came. They didn't open their mouth for 7 days and seven nights and talk to Job. After a couple minutes, after not more than 30 minutes, I'd be saying something. "Now, I brought you a card, Job." Yeah, something. But these 7 days and seven nights, and there's not a word. This is what Job's going through. Chapter 3, verse 1, we begin some talking. "After this, opened Job his mouth and cursed his day. And Job spake and said, Let the day perish wherein I was born, and the night in which it was said, There is a man-child conceived. Let that day be darkness. Let not God regard it from above, neither let light shine upon it. Let darkness and the shadow of death stain it. Let a cloud dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it." He's asking for his birthday to be erased off the calendar. "It had been better I had never been born." Verse 11, "Why died I not from the womb? Why did I not give up the ghost when I came out of the belly?" Verse 25, "For the thing which I greatly feared is come upon me, and that which I was afraid of is come unto me. I was not in safety, neither had I rest, neither was I quiet, yet trouble came." Job laments in sorrow. It says he curses his day. "Oh, if it hadn't been that way, if things could have been different, oh, I wish I never would have had. Why did I not die when I was an infant like so many did in those days?" And Job has this question. You might summarize the question he has up in the back of his mind as why. In fact, he says many times, why? Why? In verse 25, we see that he had a fear that something like this would happen. "The thing which I greatly feared has come upon me." I think Job knew that life was unstable in a sinful world. He knew that problems came to men. He saw others suffering. And he thought, wow, my life is so good. My children, they're doing well. My finances are right where they should be. In fact, they're doing excellently. And I'm trying to walk with God. Even in verse 26, it says, "I was not in safety, neither had I rest, neither was I quiet." He wasn't sitting back on his laurels and saying, "Wow, I'm such a great guy. I'm so spiritual." And he wasn't in neutral mode. He was actively working on his relationship with God. He was actively sacrificing to God. He was actively trying to be the man of character that he knew to be. He was not just leaning back on his heels and just saying, "Well, life is good, and I can just kind of relax, and I don't have to worry about." No, he was working at everything he knew to work at, and trouble came. So Job, he laments. He complains. Chapter 4, his friend Eliphaz speaks up. Now, there's a batting order here. Eliphaz starts. He gets to speak for a while, has a monologue, and then Job responds for a couple chapters. Then Bildad takes a shot, and then Job responds. Then Zophar, and then Job responds. And that's how it goes chapter 4 to chapter 31. Three times through the batting order, except for Zophar. He must have been second string. But three times through the batting order, each one speaks, and Job responds, and they go back and forth. There must be a crowd that's listening in. Perhaps it's the media of the day. I don't know. But at some point in chapter 32, a young man named Elihu speaks up. And he's been sitting there quiet because he's been respecting his elders and letting them speak. But finally, when everybody stops talking, he says, "Ah, I'm going to give my 2 cents worth." And he speaks for a few chapters. That takes us to chapter 37. Chapter 42 is already in sight. We're almost there. But before we get there, we have to look at that conversation. A lot of conversation. The friends respond to Job's grief. Verse 2 of chapter 4, Eliphaz is speaking. "If we assay, if we plan to commune with thee, will you be grieved?" In other words, Job, may we talk? "But who can withhold himself from speaking? Behold, thou hast instructed many. Thou hast strengthened the weak hands. Thy words have upholden him that was falling." Verse 5, "But now it has come upon thee, and thou faintest." Job, you used to help people out that were down and out. Now we're here to help you. And Eliphaz responds. Now, there's something that these three friends can't shake out of their head. They come with an assumption about God. And this assumption, I believe, still lives on in the minds of believers today, perhaps even in our minds. An assumption about God that sounds pretty good. But we need to understand more than just a surface understanding of that assumption. Because if we take that assumption and we run with it, we're going to end up like these three friends. Job's speech in chapter 3 kind of shocked the friends because he didn't live in their world. He didn't acknowledge their assumption. He was thinking on a different level than they were thinking. This is their assumption. Do right and God will bless you. Do wrong and suffer evil. Now, doesn't that sound correct? Doesn't that sound biblical? If you do what is right, God will bless you. If you do wrong, then you will suffer evil, suffer judgment in this life. Is that not an assumption that we hold? Well, if I do what's right, you know, if you're a child, if I do what's right, I'm not going to get punished. If I do what's wrong, I'm going to get punished. That is an assumption that I have. But let's look at it. Job did not come with that assumption. He did not acknowledge that in chapter 3. Chapter 4, verse 7, Eliphaz says, "Remember, I pray thee, whoever perished, being innocent, or where were the righteous cut off? Even as I have seen, they that plow iniquity and sow wickedness reap the same." Look in chapter 5. Verse 17, Eliphaz is still speaking. Chapter 5, verse 17. "Behold, happy is the man whom God correcteth. Therefore despise not thou the chastening of the Almighty." Proverbs chapter 12, verse 21. Give me a moment to turn there. I did not write this down. Proverbs 12, verse 21. Solomon wrote, "There shall no evil happen to the just, but the wicked shall be filled with mischief." There shall no evil happen to the just, but the wicked shall be filled with mischief. That was Solomon's observation. Is it true? Unqualified. Without any commentary, is it true that if you do right, God's going to bless you, and if you do wrong, you're going to suffer evil, and never the twain shall mix? It is not. That assumption is faulty, but that's what they assumed. Now, these three friends, they spoke much good about God. In chapter 8, verse 3, Bildad is asking a question. Chapter 8, verse 3, "Doth God pervert judgment? Or doth the Almighty pervert justice?" Oh no, the assumed answers are no. God is just. God does what is right. Can God do what is right and Job still be in the case he's in? Chapter 11, verse 6. This is Zophar speaking. Chapter 11, verse 6. And that he would show thee the secrets of wisdom, that they are double to that which is. Notice this last half of verse 6. Know therefore that God exacteth of thee less than thine iniquity deserveth. Zophar said, Job, you've sinned. God is being merciful and giving you less than you even deserve. They're upholding justice. These friends are even upholding God's mercy. In verse 7, canst thou by searching find out God? Canst thou find out the Almighty unto perfection? Can you understand God all the way, Job? They knew that God cannot be completely understood by man. And yet, their assumption makes them guilty of thinking that they had God all figured out. That it was black and white. That it was this or that. That it was either you're doing right and being rewarded or you're doing wrong and you're getting judged. That was their assumption. They thought they had it figured out. This is a superstitious understanding of God, where it's a quid pro quo. I do something for God and he does something for me. I put money in the vending machine and blessings come out. I do what is right. I earn his favor and he gives me his favor. On the flip side is I do what is wrong and I break God's commands and God judges. That's the stark difference. That's the understanding of God. That's a superstitious understanding. If I do these rituals, I'll be blessed. That's ultimately the teaching of the prosperity gospel preacher, where they say, if you buy things for me so I can buy jets and Rolls Royces and all nice houses and stuff, then you're going to be blessed. If you plant some money in the church, it's going to grow and you're going to be blessed. If you do what's right, God's going to bless you. Now, is that generally true? Generally. Is it generally true if you do what is right, God blesses? God has built blessings into the system of life. You are careful when you're driving in the mountains around curves. If you are careful, you do not fall off the side of the mountain generally. God builds the blessing of safety into your exercise of being diligent and driving carefully. Now, you get to the side of the road and you decide, you know what, I'm just going to see what happens. And you drive right off the side of the mountain. God has built in a consequence called gravity and physics and wrecked cars. There are inherent evils that God has built into the system. When we do not follow his design, evil happens. Generally, this assumption works. Generally. But is it always? It's not general, like it might be an exception for you and for you, but it's a general for all of us, and all of us are also the exception. These friends, with this assumption, try to get Job to see that he's wrong. Job, you have sinned. You sinned, and God's judging you for your evil. And Zophar, he's a pretty blunt guy. He says, it must have been awful sin, because look how awfully you got judged. Remember, we're not thinking about chapter 2 right now. We're not thinking about Satan and God and what's happening behind the scenes. We're thinking about what Job lost all of this stuff. He went out to sit down in the ashes. His friends come 7 days, they sit with him. Then they open up their mouth and they say, Job, you're a sinner. God's judging you for your sin. Get right with God. And Job says, I haven't sinned. In chapter 6, verse 24, Job states something, and it carries through the rest of the book. Chapter 6, verse 24, teach me, and I will hold my tongue. Cause me to understand wherein I have erred. How forcible are right words. But what doth your arguing reprove? Job was willing. He said, hey, if there's something I've done that's wrong, tell me. And I'll make it right. But I haven't done anything wrong. Job held on to what he knew was true. Now, these are not pretty polite discussions as they go through chapter 4 through chapter 31. These are friends who are going at it. Would you go to chapter 5, verse 27? So Eliphaz is winding down his first speech. And listen to this, these words of recommendation that he gives to his own advice. Chapter 5, verse 27, "Lo, this, we have searched it, and so it is. Hear it, and know thou it for thy good." Basically, he said, here's my advice. Oh, I wrote a book on it, and I wrote the recommendation on the back cover for myself. We've looked at, we figured it out. This is the advice that we have for you, and it's good. It's true. So take it. There's Eliphaz. Look in chapter 11, verse 2. This is Zophar. Listen how he just lays into Job. Verse 2. "Should not the multitude of words be answered? And should not a man full of talk be justified? Should thy lies make men hold their peace? And when thou mockest, shall no man make thee ashamed?" Basically, Zophar is saying, hey, Job, you should be quiet and let other people, like, we're gonna talk you down because you're saying things that are foolish. Verse 4, "Thou hast said, my doctrine is pure, and I am clean in thine eyes." Verse 5, "But oh, that God speak and open his lips against thee, Job, and that God would show thee the secrets of wisdom, that they are double that to that which is. Know therefore that God exacteth of thee less than thine iniquity deserveth." Chapter 12, verse 2, listen to Job's response. "No doubt, but ye are the people." That's like saying you're the man. And Job says, you are the people, and wisdom shall die with you. There's no wisdom in the world but what you're giving me. I chuckle like you did. These guys, they are going at it. This is not just soft, you know, polite conversation. Hey, how is your day going? Okay, I'm praying for you. They are going at it. Chapter 15, verse 2. Eliphaz says, "Should a wise man utter vain knowledge and fill his belly with the east wind? Should he reason with unprofitable talk or with speeches wherein he can do no good? Yea, thou casteth off fear and restraineth prayer before God, for thy mouth uttereth thine iniquity, and thou choosest the tongue of the crafty." Verse 6, "Thine own mouth condemneth thee, Job, and not I. Yea, thine own lips testify against thee. Art thou the first man that was born? Or wert thou made before the hills? Hast thou heard the secret of God, and dost thou restrain wisdom to thyself?" Verse 10, "With us are both the gray-headed and very aged men, much elder than thy father." Do you hear the insults that are flying here? The Job, we know better than you. Job, stop talking all this nonsense. We're here to straighten you out. Chapter 16, would you look there? Chapter 16, verse 1. "Then Job answered and said, I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters, all ye all. Shall vain words have an end?" They're not even halfway through the book, and Job is saying, y'all are no use to me. You're making my misery worse. All these words are just empty. Why? Because his assumption about God was not the same as their assumption about God, that God always rewards those who do what is right with good, and he only rewards those who do what's wrong with evil, and never the twain mix. One commentator noted this: if everyone believed, as Job believed, that God does not always punish the wicked and reward the godly immediately, then what motive would people have for obeying God? If people serve God only for what they get out of it, let me say that again. If people serve God only for what they get out of it, then they're not serving God at all. They're only serving themselves by making God their servant. Do you see, if Job was worshiping God so that way God would bless Job, then God was not the object of Job's worship. Job was the object of Job's worship. Job saw God as a means to an end. I will have a comfortable life if I live the way God tells me to. That's a true statement, but it's not true. I will have a comfortable life if I live the way God tells me to. Your life, there are a lot of comforts that will come when you decide to be honest, when you decide to be diligent in work, when you decide to get things right with family members and friends and not let anger and bitterness stew. There's a lot of things that do come along with it, but Job did not see God as his servant. Well, if I can use God to get what I really want, I can worship God and God will bless me with all this wealth. I will serve God and God will give me a comfortable, easy life with good friends and food on the table. You see this assumption played out in 21st century America? We get all the way down to chapter 31 and Job finishes with an extended defense of his righteousness. Would you turn there? Chapter 31, just like a machine gun, he gives us sin after sin after sin that he is not guilty of committing. All throughout the book, he has maintained his innocence. In verse 5, if I've walked with vanity or if my foot hath hastened to deceit, let me be weighed in an even balance that God may know my integrity. He said, I have not been deceitful. Verse 7, if my step hath turned out of the way, my heart walked after mine eyes, if I've been covetous, but I haven't. In verse 9, if my heart have been deceived by a woman or if I've laid wait at my neighbor's door, I'm not guilty of adultery. Verse 13, if I did despise the cause of my manservant over my maidservant when they contended with me, I did not mistreat those who were working for me. Verse 16, if I have withheld the poor from their desire or caused the eyes of the widow to fail or have eaten my morsel myself alone. Job was not guilty of being stingy. Verse 21, if I've lifted up my hand against the fatherless when I saw my help in the gate. He was not guilty of injustice. Verse 24, if I have made gold my hope, or if I said unto the fine gold, thou art my confidence. There was not idolatry in Job's life. Verse 29, if I rejoice at the destruction of him that hated me, or lifted up myself when evil found him. He was not guilty of hatred of others, even as of his enemies. In verse 33, if I cover my transgressions as Adam by hiding mine iniquity in my bosom, he's not guilty of hiding sin. He gives a whole laundry list of sins that he had not committed. He said, I have not sinned. Why is God doing this? Verse 35, oh, that one would hear me. Behold, my desire is that the Almighty would answer me, and that my adversary had written a book. Job had a stellar reputation, and he knows it. He gives it. I don't know that any of us could go through this whole list and say that this has been true in my life. I haven't done this, I haven't done that, I haven't done this. This is the way I'm living, and that's me. Job has a stellar reputation. Now, the problem with his speech here is he's challenging God in God's righteousness. God, you've judged me unjustly. I've done all this good, and you're rewarding me evil. Now, for the three friends, that doesn't fit in their assumption because only people who do evil are rewarded with evil. Job had done what was right, and Job said, I've done what's right. Why am I being rewarded with evil? That Job's experience and that false assumption have come head to head. God, you've been unjust in judging me this way. I haven't done what's wrong. Chapter 32, Elihu speaks up. He gives us 2 cents worth. He talks for 6 chapters. Sometimes I'm that way. Let me give you just a short little piece of advice or opinion, and you just go on and on. Chapter 38, would you turn there? These three friends and Job are talking. Elihu has been speaking. And I never thought about this. I was reading the commentary, and they said, well, where did this whirlwind come from? Chapter 38, the Lord spake unto Job out of the whirlwind. Excuse me, the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. He thought, you know what? Maybe there was a storm brewing on the horizon. And everybody had to stop talking. Because you know when the thunder starts thundering, the lightning gets loud, There's not a whole lot of conversation that can go on. There's a storm coming through. You know, the fact that, I think it's Nahum that says that the Lord, he has his way in the storm. A storm coming into a life, it's not the sign that God's not there. It's the fact, it's an assurance that God is there. Because God has his way in the storm. God's the one who created the storm. So when a storm comes into your life, figuratively or literally, a storm comes in and you say, God, where are you? Well, who made the storm? Who's having his way in the storm? The fact of the storm being there is not that God is gone, it's that God is there. I like how it says in verse 38, then the Lord answered Job. God had listened and he had heard it all, although he had not said a thing. God has answers. Job had questions. Chapter 3, verse 11, why did I not die from my mother's womb? Why did I not die the moment I was born? Chapter 7, verses 20 and 21, he has several questions. And over, he says, why and why and why? Why is this happening to me? You're not going to find the answer to why when God speaks in chapter 38. Chapter 39 does not have the answer to why, nor does chapter 40 or 41. You're not going to find the answer to why in the end of Job. Can I read you a quote? Those who are frustrated by God's non-explanatory answer, an answer that didn't explain, those who are frustrated by that have a fundamental flaw in their thinking. They assume that everything that takes place in the universe ought to be explained to me. They assume that God owes me an explanation and that there cannot be any good reason for God not to tell me everything I immediately want to know. Why is as one author put it, a me-centered question? But God's not really concerned about answering why. He has other concerns that he's more interested in. In fact, it's not even a need. That's not our main need to know why. Instead of why, God is concerned with who. Look in chapter 38, verse 2. Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up now thine loins like a man, Job, for I will demand of thee an answer thou me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. Who hath laid the measures thereof if thou knowest? Or who hath stretched the line upon it, whereupon the foundations thereof are fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy, or who shut up the sea over and over again, God says, who and who and who? And were you there, Job? Was it you? Was it you? Was it you? Who was it? God asks 77 questions. That's quite a final exam there. 77 questions to help Job realize that although he was a godly man, he was still a man. Job had insinuated earlier that he had done what was right and God had not treated him fairly, that God had done wrong. Chapter 40, would you look? Chapter 40, verse 7. Gird up thy loins now like a man, and I will demand of thee, and declare thou unto me. Verse 8, will thou also disannul my judgment? Will thou condemn me that thou mayest be righteous? God asked the question, Job, are you going to call me unrighteous because you're so righteous? Are we going to go head to head here, Job? Answer. Are you righteous and I'm unrighteous? Do you have to know why and I have to explain myself why? Would you agree if I did tell you why? God concludes his message with two references to two different animals that God had spoken into existence, Leviathan and Behemoth. It's interesting because this is the end of the speech we have recorded, the end of chapter 40, all of chapter 41 about Leviathan. A whole chapter given about animal. There's quite a zoo, actually, in the book of Job. There's a horse, there's an ostrich, there's Leviathan, behemoth, quite a few animals that God mentions when he's asking all his questions. And God talks about Leviathan for 34 verses in chapter 41. And I don't know if at the end he said, "Shall I go on, Job? Job, I made this." There's no answer to why this happened in Job's life. God just says, "Job, were you there? Are you God? Look what I've just spoken into existence. And how you can't even put a hook in his mouth, and you can't even control these things that I have spoken into existence, and yet you want to say, I need to know why." Now, I get it, folks. I want to know why. When things happen in my life, things fall apart, things that just seem, I want to know why. Why did this happen? Why did it fall out that way? Why did this accident happen at this time? Why? I want to know. That's a question of our human heart. And I think Job, the book of Job, gives us a good answer. The answer is that we're asking the wrong question. Then instead of why, the question should be who? Am I God? Or is God God? God is not accountable to me. God has not lost control, nor has his care changed, even though I'm suffering evil when I have done what is right. Job responds in verse 2 of chapter 42, complete humility. "I know that thou canst do everything, and that no thought can be hidden from thee." Verse 3, "Who is he that hideth counsel without knowledge? Therefore have I uttered that I understood not, these things too wonderful for me which I knew not." Verse 6, "Wherefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes." There's no, "Okay, Lord, I'm sorry, but why? Can you tell me why anyway?" Why has left Job's mind? Because he saw God for who God is. And when we see God for who he is, we see ourselves properly. Now, Job's friends, they get corrected by the Lord. In verse 7, it says that the Lord talked to Eliphaz, "My wrath is kindled against thee and against thy two friends, for ye have not spoken of me the thing that is right." Now, Eliphaz and his friends said a lot of good things about God, a lot of correct things that other Bible would substantiate and say, yes, that is true about our God. But God said, no, there's a problem here. There is an assumption. There's something that you said that was wrong. And it goes back to, God is not a vending machine. God does not reward people who worship him. He does not pay people to worship him. We know the end of the story. Chapter 10, the Lord turned the captivity of Job when he prayed for his friends. And the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Verse 14, he called the name of the first Jemima, the name of the second Keziah. That's my youngest daughter there. Although we spell it with an H on the end. Keziah, I just had to throw that in there. Job is abundantly blessed by God. Here's a question that bugs me. Why didn't Job just invent a sin, confess it, and move on with life? It would have saved a lot of chapters of talk. All those friends that are coming and beating Job up. "Job, you've sinned. Confess your sin and make it right." Job could have just said, "Okay, I stole some chewing gum from the store." Job could have invented a sin, confessed it, and he would have saved all the friends from making their hurtful accusations. According to the theology of the three friends, a confession would have brought him back into God's blessing and God's favor. But it also would have handed Satan a resounding victory. If Job had just said, "Okay, I've sinned." Now, how can confessing sin give Satan a victory? Usually we think, well, if I confess my sin, God is faithful to forgive it. Satan doesn't want God to forgive my sin, so how could a confession of sin give Satan a victory? Well, it happens to be that Satan is the father of lies. And if you confess something that's not true, you're with him. And I know it's late, but I want to get to the end of Job here. Why didn't he just make up a situation and make up a sin and confess it? Well, chapter 1, in chapter 2, you find that Satan was looking for some way to attack God. Satan, where have you been? Oh, I've been going around, Lord. Here and there, you know, north and south, east and west. And God says, hey, have you considered Job? God had something that he had to prove to mankind. He had to prove to you and me because he knew our situation in 2022. He had to prove something to us, and he said, let's pick a man, Satan. Let's have a battle. Satan accuses God of being fake. God, you're not really worthy of worship. You pay people to worship you. I mean, look at Job. You can't get anybody to worship you out of their own free will. You have to pay people. You have to give them blessings for them to worship you. Job worships, God provides. Job says nice things about God, God gives him wealth. That's how it works, God. That's the accusation Satan has. God says, okay, Satan, let's see if that's true. Let's prove who I really am. You can take all his stuff. And Job lost all his things. Job refused to deny God, and Satan slinks back into heaven. And he says, well, he still has his life and his health. He can get it all back if he works really hard. And God says, okay, you can take his health, but you can't kill him. And God takes his health. Now, most of us haven't lost the wealth that Job has lost. Most of us haven't lost the health that Job has lost. But we've all lost things here along the way. And God permits Satan to take all these things away. And at the end of chapter 1, the end of chapter 2, Job has sinned not. Job has said, blessed be the name of the Lord. Job has worshiped God out of his own free will with no payment. In fact, when God has given him a bad deal, Job has said, I will still bless God's name. Satan slinks away after that, and we don't hear of him again. Not even mentioned again the rest of the book after chapter 2. One author summarized saying, Job's three friends said Job was suffering because he had sinned, and that was not true. Elihu said that God was chastening Job to make him a better man, and that's partly true. But the fundamental reason for Job's suffering was to silence the blasphemous accusation of Satan and to prove that a man could honor God even when he had lost everything. Job's life was a battlefield where the forces of God and Satan were engaged in a spiritual struggle to decide the question, is Jehovah God worthy of man's worship? No payments, no blessings. Is God worthy of worship? If I use God as a means to another end, it's the other end that's my God, not Jehovah God. Is God enough without all the blessings he gives along the way? Is God enough without all the help he sends each day? Is God enough? Even Satan will question and say, is God enough? If we lost it all, would God be enough? If Job had given in to his friends' pressuring and made up a sin to confess merely to receive the blessings of God again, he would have handed Satan the victory and the whole book would have been a loss. Instead, Satan receives a resounding defeat at the hands of a man who is confused, a man who is broken, but a man who is believing in God. James chapter 5, verse 22. James writes, ye have heard of the patience of Job. It's actually chapter 322, I believe. There's no 522. It's in James. You have heard of the patience of Job. I apologize. Patience is the idea of remaining under. It's remaining under the load during trial. Job did not slip out. He did not confess a sin and just say, forget it. He was patient. He knew what was true, and he was confused. He did not turn against God. Though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. Oh, God's refining fire, I'm going to come forth as gold. Job never gave up what he knew to be true. He remained under the truth. He did not try to end it all and just curse God and die. He lamented. He expressed honestly what was on his heart, but Job never forsook God. Job responded to suffering with submission. At the end of the day, he learned that God can be all-powerful, God can be all-knowing and all-caring, and God can allow him to suffer when he has done nothing wrong. He took an assumption and he enriched the knowledge of God that we have. We know more of God, who he is, not what the three friends said, but what we found out throughout the book of Job, that God can be in control of every situation. He can be sovereign, that he can know the details of what's going on, and that he can care about it and be compassionate. He can be all three of those and allow evil into my life when there was no sin that called down evil for judgment. Let me ask, how do you respond to your suffering? Now, most of us couldn't hold a candle in comparison to Job in his righteousness. Much of our suffering, I'm afraid, is a direct result of our own sinful choices. But when you suffer, and why? And it seems unjust that God is not being fair to you, how do you respond? I encourage you, respond how Job responded. There was a lot of talk, there was a lot of back and forth, but at the end of the day, Job came out and said, God, you are God, and I am not, and I don't need to know why, but I trust you, and I believe you. The story of Job is a help to me. I hope it's a help to you. Let's pray, and we'll be dismissed. Lord,